You're listening to the 5 Leadership Questions podcast, brought to you by Ministry Grid. Ministry Grid is an online church leadership and volunteer training platform offering a library of thousands of videos and a suite of powerful admin tools to provide practical training for every area of ministry in your church. Find out more and get a free 30-day trial at ministrygrid.com/howitworks. Welcome to the 5 Leadership Questions podcast. I'm your host, Barnabas Piper, here with Todd Adkins, the Director of Leadership at Lifeway Christian Resources. Today, we're asking 5 leadership questions with Matt Perman, who's the author of the book, What's Best Next? A really helpful book about the gospel and productivity, two things you don't often hear merged together. It's a unique perspective on things. Matt is the former director of strategy at Desiring God and currently is doing consulting with various ministries and businesses. Welcome to the podcast, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't we start off, just tell us a little bit about yourself, your leadership role, your consulting role, your book, just anything that gives people a sense of who it is we're talking to today.
Yeah, I have an MDiv in Biblical and Theological Studies from Southern Seminary and was at Desiring God Ministries for 13 years. And I was director of internet for a while there and then director of strategy. And one interesting thing I did in that role was actually design a set of leadership and management philosophies for the organization based on gospel-centered principles. Now what I do is I write and speak. I do workshops in churches and nonprofits on productivity and leadership and things like that. And I'm getting ready to start on my next book.
Tell us a little bit about what differentiates the What's Best Next, that gospel-centric productivity philosophy from sort of some of the, you know, 4-hour work week or getting things done.
So, I mean, when it first came out, I was really excited about it because you have...
Which one? Matt's or the 4-hour work week?
Well, both. They're both these. But on his book, because, you know, you have classic books, business books like Execution, mm-hmm. Bossidy's Execution. So when I read through it, I think I told you, I was like, oh, this is like a sanctified execution. This is great, simply because in so many situations, I mean, I went to Southern as well back in the day, and, you know, they train us to be good preachers, but not so much the day in, day out work at the church, mm-hmm. and all of these things that just have to get done. And when you get thrown into that, you have no idea where to start. You have no idea how to prioritize. So something like this is excellent for pastors.
And you didn't come up. I mean, you didn't start with What's Best Next. You started. I mean, did you start with theology, or did you start with productivity, or have you just always been sort of a fan of both? And then we're like, these are not diametrically opposed.
I started with theology, and in fact, your dad Barnabas gave me a hard time a bit for getting into productivity and stuff. And
that's not totally surprising.
Yeah, not totally surprising. Mm-hmm. And Todd, my experience in seminary was similar to yours. Lots of great theological learning, but almost nothing on the practical side. And my first full-time job out of seminary was at Desiring God, and they gave me, like, none of us really knew what we were doing on the practical side there, so they gave me way too much to do. They said, launch John Piper on a new radio program nationally, and also run the website and redesign it and run the bookstores, and it was too much for one person to do. So I said, well, I got to learn about productivity. I started learning about it. But then there was some pushback, like, what are you doing? What happened to your theological side? And I was like, well, come on, that's a little unfair. I need to learn this in order to do my job. And I found a lot of the stuff I was reading was really awesome. Like, reading Marcus Buckingham is like reading John Piper, except he's not theological. Marcus Buckingham is a business and leadership thinker, and he's very profound. And when you read him, you're like, wow, it is fun and fascinating stuff. It's not fluffy. There's some mm-hmm. leadership and business books out there that are fluffy. And I think a lot of Christians don't like leadership because they're accustomed to seeing the fluffy stuff. And that is garbage. Stay away from that. But what they don't know is there's this amazing stuff out there, which is just as enjoyable and almost edifying of a read as a John Piper. Piper would probably hate to hear me say that.
I think he's shifting a little bit. I think, and probably in part because of some of the work you've done to show the hand-holding relationship between purposeful sense of honoring God in what you do and a purposeful sense of getting things done.
Yeah, I think so. And what I took from your dad's pushback towards me, I said, what's he really trying to get at here? What's the good heart behind it? Because there was a good heart behind it. And I think what he was saying to me was, don't think about this, don't separate it from your theological background. Think about this in a gospel-centered way, mm-hmm. not a secular way. And I said, that is good advice. And actually, it was your dad's influence that really pushed me to keep the theology and the practical together. And what sets the book apart from like the 4-hour work week and some of the other stuff is two things. First, there's the gospel-centered foundation. So be productive on the foundation of the gospel, not yourself. And then second, the service mentality. I see God has us here. One of our chief purposes is to love others. And that means meeting their needs. And as a result, the chief purpose behind our productivity is to do good for others, to make their lives better. And others there means our employers, as well as our families and communities. Whereas in like the 4-hour work week, Tim Ferriss is given all these great tips, but the ultimate aim is in the subtitle of the book, Escape 9 to 5, Live Anywhere and Join the New Rich. And it's about—
very self-centered.
It's very self-centered. Oh, yeah. And the gospel says be other-centered.
Well, right. It's a stewardship issue when you apply the theology to it. So great, you got everything done in 4 hours. Now you've got a lot more time.
Yeah.
Ministry is never done.
It is never done. And one of the things I thought was neat, like Ferriss is like, hey, if you get your job done in 4 hours or 10 hours in a week, now you can do what you really want. And I said, hey, wouldn't it be neat if as Christians we applied that time we have freed up to things like the advance of the gospel and large global problems? Like I love hearing Christians talk about fighting global poverty and injustice and things like that and helping the poor in the developing world. And I think if we become more productive and have like that extra time that can happen, like what Tim Ferriss is talking about, we can use that time to get involved in solving large global problems. And I think that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, instead of the work-leisure dichotomy, you have sort of there's a purpose to everything and everything has its place. It's much more fulfilling in a— yeah. Without sort of that self-centered, like, I'm doing this for me.
Exactly. I think it is more fulfilling. Yeah. And there's Christian hedonism right there.
Yeah. Well, you know, we talked about a number of different authors already, Buckingham and David Allen and Tim Ferriss and John Piper and some others. So you're clearly a reader.
I read a lot, yeah.
Who are you learning from right now? It doesn't have to be books. It could be podcasts you listen to, speakers you enjoy listening to. But who are you learning from right now?
Yeah, I am always learning from Jim Collins, famous, you know, mm-hmm. business thinker that lots of Christians refer to his book Good to Great, which is a great book. But his best book is actually Built to Last, which he wrote before that.
Totally agree.
Yeah, it's awesome. And I'm actually writing an op-ed for Christianity Today right now on why Christians need to learn from secular thinking. So a lot of the people I'm learning from are secular thinkers like Jim Collins. I mentioned Marcus mm-hmm. Buckingham. Stephen Covey. I'm always going back to his book, Principle-Centered Leadership, and his time management book, First Things First, because he really outlines a servant leadership approach, which I think is biblical. Patrick Lencioni, great business thinker. I think he's a Christian even. And actually, ironically, I'm a Reformed guy. And so it'll be surprising to hear me say this. But like, I learned a lot from Bill Hybels mm-hmm. on leadership. He's got great stuff on leadership.
Absolutely.
And some Reformed folks are like, well, kind of stay away from Willow Creek stuff. And I find it very helpful. Yeah, I would have a different viewpoint on some things in terms of the seeker-sensitive movement, but they've got really solid stuff on leadership.
Yeah, I think what you just described is something that I think Christian leaders, especially in the church, would really benefit from, and that's that kind of moving away from the provincialism or the sectarianism, that idea of I will only listen to voices in my camp, because then it just becomes an echo chamber. Exactly. where the ideas that thrive in this space— just you reproduce the same good, but you also reproduce all the same problems. And unless you can introduce some of that outside thinking, so in a Reformed world, maybe it's Bill Hybels. In the Christian world as a whole, it's Jim Collins and some of these other guys. That's where you break the patterns of whether it's productivity or the wrong type of vision or you know, the just negative styles of leadership, those kinds of things. You have to bring that stuff in.
I love the way you said that. I think you're exactly right. If we are just in an echo chamber, then we're reproducing the same sets of problems. So we have to do something that gets us beyond the echo chamber.
I think that helps us transition into the second question. So what's the main point of emphasis in your leadership right now? Like, what are you really focused in on?
The main point of emphasis in my leadership is servant leadership. And I mean something specific by that. One guy tweeted to me, like, oh, servant leadership is postmodern. Simon Greenleaf, who wrote the book on servant leadership, you know, wasn't a Christian, whatever. And I take servant leadership as a term that helps summarize what I think the Bible teaches about how we should lead. It might not always be in accord with exactly what is in that book, servant leadership, but there are a set of principles there that are really crucial. And one of the biggest ones is that I believe leaders should lead from purpose and values rather than command and control. So, for example, when I was at Desiring God, if ever I, you know, wanted the people who work for me to do something, I wouldn't just come down with raw authority. I would tie it back to our purpose and our values because I wanted them to know why. And that creates engagement and motivation because you want people to be intrinsically motivated. And if you're just commanding and controlling them, you're not creating that intrinsic motivation. And you're not developing the person either because you're not enabling them to build up their judgment. Then the other thing, ironically, that is central to servant leadership is realizing that there are limits on the leader's authority. So the role of the leader is not to exert himself as much as possible. It's to actually affirm the other person's freedom and even protect their scope of freedom as much as possible. So a good leader wants to maximize freedom, and that means realizing it's not all about him or her as the leader. It's about allowing the person to develop themselves and exercise their own judgment and creativity.
It reminds me of a quote, and honestly, I can't remember who said it, but basically that the leader of the past told and the leader of the future will ask.
I love it. Yeah, that's right. And you can ask, and here's why you can ask. But this is why servant leadership is more demanding. You can ask if you really know what you're talking about. And then they know that what you're asking is coming from a well-informed point of view. So you have authority. You want to rely on the authority of position as little as possible and the authority of knowledge and expertise as much as possible. So when you're asking, there is a real influence there if you know what you're talking about. But if you're the type of leader that doesn't understand the issues very well, isn't a good thinker, then when you ask, it's going to be harder to see your desires accomplished because people, you won't have that credibility with them. And this is why servant leadership is harder. And a lot of people turn away from it because it is harder in that way. They don't want to do the hard work to educate themselves, be informed on the issues.
I do think too, though, as you exercise that, as you ask your team to do things or ask them for their opinion or draw that out, it does build, you know, unity on the team, it builds loyalty. And at a certain point in time, you are going to have to tell.
Sometimes you are. That's exactly right. Yeah.
And so by doing that, you've built up enough relational equity, leadership equity. We're both passionate about the same thing. This is where we're going.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we've got to make a decision, and you may not agree with it, but this is what we're going to do. And that happens occasionally.
Well, absolutely.
Some of that's even a work style thing. So I work under Todd, and we have a work relationship, our whole team does, half a dozen of us or so, where there's a lot of back and forth, trying to figure out the best way to do things, and everybody's ideas on the table. It's pretty equitable that way. But I've asked Todd, I said, if you really need me to do something and you don't, like, my feedback is no longer helpful, just put your foot down. And just say, we're going to do this thing.
Yep.
My team
has seen that a time or two, which is why.
And I need to hear that because I will continue to push back and push back and push back, thinking I'm being helpful until he, as the leader, has to make the decision on what's best here is this, and we're just going to do it. So no more feedback. Let's go.
Yep.
And that helps me just work style wise because then I can buy into that. I just know that's clearly the direction, the decision's been made, and off we go.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, especially when the leader is making that decision on the basis of sound principles and knowledge. And sometimes the people that are working for him, they don't have that same knowledge base, and there might not be the time or just not might not be the occasion to do all the educating. And but the most important thing there is that the leader be saying, we're doing it this way, not out of personal ego or because he just thinks he's smarter than everyone, but because he's actually informed on the issue, and it is based on principles. It is the right decision to make.
And from the employee perspective, there's the value of being heard.
Absolutely.
Ask mentality usually fits in a leadership culture of conversation, feedback, back and forth, so that if a decision is made and it's not necessarily the one I would have made, that's okay. My opinion was heard, it was valued, it was considered, another decision was made, but it wasn't just sort of over my head and nobody cares what I think.
Oh, absolutely. That is so important. People want to be heard, and they are much more willing and motivated to go along with decisions that they wouldn't necessarily agree with when they know they've been heard. And I would say, and this is why I think servant leadership is so important for Christians. It not only works best, because it does, but I think it's also the right thing to do because it's respecting the image of God in people. Mm-hmm. Because people are in the image of God, they always need to be treated with respect, and part of that is letting them be heard.
Let's move on to question three, which is, what obstacles are you currently facing in leadership? That could be self-leadership or sort of an organizational, directional kind of thing. So what is the leadership obstacle that looms large for you?
The biggest obstacle for me right now is that I'm self-employed, and I don't really like that very much because I like having coworkers. So it causes me to struggle with fulfillment. On the one hand, there's a greater sense of fulfillment in that I have even greater direction over my own day. In another sense, there's less fulfillment because there's less baked-in interaction with people. And that makes it in some ways harder to be motivated. Isn't that, so that's a self-leadership issue, obstacle, and I'm continually trying to figure out how to solve that. But ultimately, I think I don't want to keep working for myself. Mm-hmm. I want to be plugged back into an organization.
Quick, so in being self-employed, you obviously, like you said, you go speak to organizations and churches. You're drawing on past experience. Your present experience is distinctly different. The only person you're leading currently is you. So what does that challenge feel like in terms of going in and say, I'm going to go talk to a church staff or a group of church leaders, and I'm going to tell them how to do some things or give them my best. Yeah. But if they looked at my everyday life, I'm working in a home office with only me. So does that feel like an odd juxtaposition?
It can feel a bit odd sometimes. So a lot of times I'll refer back to my past experience. Mm-hmm. The big thing that's odd about it is one of the reasons I can't be working in an organization right now is I don't know how else I would have the time to go speak at these churches and do workshops if I was employed for, say, you know, Christian company XYZ. And so in one sense, I kind
of unless that company valued what you were doing as part of the role.
Great point. Yeah, exactly. And so it does feel kind of odd, but because I have the past experience, the 13 years, then I feel like, you know, I've got a lot, you know, that I'm able to refer back to.
You should just come to work for Lifeway because that's pretty much what we do every day. I talk to churches every day. I've traveled every week for the last month to go visit with churches and talk to them about leadership pipeline and multi-site and a couple of other things. Matt.
That sounds good. I'm very open.
we'll talk later. So, like you said, you're self-employed, which means you work at home or a home office or possibly from coffee shops or whatever. But since you spend so much time at home, what does leadership look like there for you? So you're helping people with organizational leadership. You're leading yourself, but you have a family. You have several kids. You've been married for as long as I've known you, which goes back 15 years-ish.
Yeah, we met in 98, I think. Probably at a Pizza Hut.
Yep, there was a lot of Pizza Hut back then. So what does leadership look like in your home?
So for me, raising my kids in a major way is about developing them to be leaders when they grow up. And that means equipping them to be self-sustaining and not have a wait until told mentality. Be the type of people that take initiative and see themselves as capable of making a contribution and valuing freedom. So I was influenced. Is it Ted Tripp who wrote Shepherding a Child's Heart?
Yep.
There's some things in there I disagree with. But he talks about how as your kids get older, you need to focus more on developing character and judgment. And that means backing off on the rules a bit so that there's more space for their initiative. And that became a key part of my parenting philosophy. As the kids get older, it's more about giving them more freedom so that they have practice exercising judgment and using freedom well, and then becoming the type of people. See, a leader needs to be someone who's not just automatically going to accept the status quo, who doesn't just see something done a certain way and say, oh, well, that's the way things need to be done. I just need to get on board with that. Now, we don't want to be like quarrelsome troublemakers and things like that. But the thing is, people who make a difference and lead are the people who don't say, well, that's the way it's always been done. I just better do it that way. Suck it up. They need to be willing to say it can be done better. We can change things, and they need to take the initiative to do that. So I try and raise my kids to be that way.
Yeah, and they always ask why.
Oh, yeah.
And so they may accept the answer and go, yeah, oh, that's a good reason. But if you ask why about things that have always been done this way, so to speak, yeah, you can begin to kind of unravel a lot of the stuff that doesn't make sense because you go, oh, that doesn't even have a reason. We just do it that way because it was on the calendar for the last 25 years.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And that's why it's so important never to shut down questions. Mm-hmm. And in Barnabas, I mean, I think this relates to your upcoming book coming out. I read recently that one of the biggest reasons people walk away from the faith is because no one had answers to their tough questions, in this case about the faith, mm-hmm, and sometimes, a lot of times, people would shut them down as if it was unspiritual to ask questions. I think as a leader, the people you lead in your organization and in your family, raising your kids, you can never shut down questions. You need to applaud and celebrate questions and have those hard discussions, and it's fun too.
And I think this is obviously a little bit different in an organization than with children. I have two daughters. How many kids? Yeah, three kids. Okay. So, there does come a point where you have to end a conversation. But one of the challenges for me as a dad is to end it without going, that's it. Just listen.
Yeah, right.
And instead of going, you know, we have to go do something else. So we can talk about this later. Let's think about it. I'm not very good at that. It is top-down leadership comes more naturally in the home.
Yeah.
Especially when your kid is 9 and you know you're an adult and you just go, I know better than you.
Yeah.
So to have that sort of open-ended, that's a really good question. We didn't settle everything. This is my thoughts on it. Let's talk about it again later. But right now, that's not an easy thing to do.
No, it's not. And I think that is the way to do it. Instead of just ending the discussion with, well, this is the way it is, it's you got to end the conversation at that time, but with the mindset of picking it up again later. And I it's amazing. What I find is top-down leadership, the top-down aspects of leadership work better when the dominant model is servant leadership. Like, I'm amazed at my kids. Whenever I tell my oldest son to take out the trash, he does it right away. When I ask my daughter to help me pick up the kitchen, she does it right away. They obey so quickly. And when I do just have to tell them to do something, they do it, and they do it joyfully.
Well, let's hit our fifth question here. You've been talking about your kids and the way you raised them in the home. Think about back when you were 20 years old. Yeah. So you had just left home. You've got a couple years under your belt. You know, you can call your life your own. What would you tell your 20-year-old self about preparing to lead?
That's a great question, because in some ways, I'd say I'd tell my 20-year-old self wisdom on how to navigate my career, but because I just had no idea how to navigate a career when I was in college and when I got out of college.
Do you feel like you know how to navigate one now? That's not a shot at you. That's because I'm not entirely sure how to do that either.
So I've been trying to dig down further into that and research it better the last few years. I think I've been learning it better. But here's the odd thing. I think some of the things worked out for me well in my 20s precisely because I didn't know how to navigate a career. So some of the mistakes I made were very happy accidents, which worked out really well for me. So if I had maybe known all the good principles, I might not have made the decisions that were the most meaningful for me. So it's this odd balance. Maybe that just shows that the way to navigate a career actually is very unconventional, based more on emotion and the type of people you want to be working with, as opposed to more rational.
Sort of the factors. Professional development progression mindset.
Yeah, because that's the mindset I sort of had. Because you look, that's the way people thought in the 50s, 60s. That's the way my parents' generation thought. And that's the way I thought I had to navigate my career. But what I saw was there's no way to do that. And I took my first job out of college. I got fired from because I wouldn't do something illegal. He was selling insurance. But then my job after that was at Desiring God, answering phones for $15,000 a year. I was expecting to make $40,000 a year. That's what people, you know, college graduates made at that time. And I didn't even see a career trajectory. This was at Desiring God Ministries. Mm-hmm. I was like, where is it going to lead? But I was like, but this is a great organization. I want to be part of what they're doing. So I took the job. But I was immediately out of my expected career progression framework, and I was just in a totally new career navigation territory.
So 20-year-old, so you mentioned I would tell myself this, but I'm not sure I would tell myself.
Exactly.
Just be like, go for it.
That's why I have a hard time speaking in college classrooms on this. Like, I've given like 3 messages now on how to navigate your career to college students. Each time it's a little better. But what I'm trying to guard against is giving them the type of advice that would have killed the meaningful decisions I made in my 20s.
I think a takeaway from what you just said, though, is that there are certain people who need real concrete advice. Like, you make the logical progression decision, and that will work out best. Uh-huh. For you, those kind of decisions may have, I don't know if derailed is the right word. It certainly would have put you on a different track.
Yeah.
Whereas you seem to like your life right now, and so you don't want to go back and redo that. Yeah. So I think a takeaway has to just be that there's not a one-size-fits-all set of career advice.
That's a great point. And that I think that ties much into leadership, because a lot of people say the meaning of leadership is not that you can follow a map, it's that you can draw your own maps. Mm-hmm. And that means in order to be a good leader, you need to understand not first of all practices, but principles. So if you have a set of good principles and you're grounded in the Bible and you put God first and you have a few, you know, very solid biblical and common grace principles, then you can navigate unknown territory and you can find your way because you have a compass, even though you don't have a map.
Well, I think that is a great place to land on. Thanks so much for being on with us, Matt. We really appreciate you coming in, taking the time.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Well, that was this week's episode of the 5 Leadership Questions podcast. We'd love it if you'd be so kind as to jump on iTunes, leave us a rating and review. That helps other leaders like yourself find the podcast and hopefully find it beneficial. Thank you so much for listening and tune in next time. Thank you for listening to the 5 Leadership Questions podcast. To learn more about how you can train leaders in your church, visit ministrygrid.com/howitworks and watch a short demo video. For participating, you will get a free 30-day trial for your entire church. Again, that's ministrygrid.com/howitworks.